You want me to get you a hard chair?
No.
Okay. Your questions aren't going to be on tape, so do you want me to say them in so you know where you were, or?
If you want. I kind of know them, but maybe
okay.
It might be easier.
No problem.
Do you want me to ask them, or do you have them?
Well, if you have an order you want to go in, or I could just sort of go down them as you said them.
No, whatever way you want to go.
Okay. To me, so much of what happens to an artist or a worker or whatever one ends up doing with one's life has to do with what environment they're raised in. And sometimes it seems important when judging or criticizing or dealing with either a public person or a friend or a relative or whatever encounter you have with a person is to know where they come from, literally as well as what changes their head has been through, and so that you know how to judge what they're saying. It seems real important to me to make criticisms based on what an artist intends to do and what their goals are, as opposed to just some sort of general criticism. So when in relationship to asking someone about their background, for instance, it seems like there's a couple things one needs to know, like whether they come from a privileged background, a white background, all of those things which are stepping stones to a different kind of finale than if one has to struggle with other elements of survival. I was raised on a farm in Northern California, and we were not real rich in money, but we had land. We owned our own land. That, in comparison, say, to a farm worker who doesn't have a lot of money but also doesn't own the land, doesn't own the life which he or she is working on, doesn't have any control over their life. So they are having to struggle to create a union. But we had the wealth of ownership, even though we didn't have a lot of cash to go out and buy clothes and cars or whatever. And we also had leeway. One of the things that having any kind of possessions can do is give you the leeway to breathe a little bit. Like, for instance, if we wanted to take music lessons, we wouldn't have to get them on credit, that there was money available to go and get those music lessons. Even if it meant having less of something else, there was still that option was there. So I come from a lot of privilege in that respect and a lot of support. My parents were had gone through the struggles of the labor movement during and after the war, the McCarthy period, and they had real concerns and interests in political activity, but also gave us a lot of room not to necessarily have to have their politics, you know. If we came in and said some really reactionary right-wing thing, they would maybe express their opinion, but they wouldn't kick us out of the house or tell us we were fools or whatever, because they figured we would end up making decisions on our own. And so coming from that kind of support and that kind of privilege defines or explains a lot, I think, of why I'm doing what I'm doing now. But en route to getting here, I went through a lot of reactionary kind of things, experiences. Popularity became real important to me. I was a football princess. I wanted to be a star for a while. I'd been performing since I was 7, and it was never to become a star until some certain point in my life where all of a sudden I got the idea that you weren't just supposed to be a singer, you just have to have a career and become somebody, that just singing around the community wasn't enough. And I started thinking about getting a record contract when I was 13, went down and auditioned at Columbia Records, did all of that. And when it came down time to sign the papers with a manager, I all of a sudden understood that I didn't want to do that, that I wanted to have a normal upbringing, that I wanted to be a kid like everybody, all these other kids. I didn't want to be somebody special. And so I decided not to and came back to the farm. And yeah, about when I was 13, I think it was. And just went on through high school. And I think in some ways that's what made me do things like want to be a cheerleader and want to be a football princess and want to be a student leader and a vice president of my class and all that sort of thing, was in reaction to this other option which had made itself available. And after that, I I did go to performing arts schools and take a lot of lessons and things, and went to UCLA, and sort of by accident got into film and television because I had done a scene at UCLA with one of the other students, which a lot of agents had seen. And when they came and taught, said, "I'm an agent, would you like to sign with us to do film and television?" I didn't know what an agent was. I mean, I really didn't have a lot of consciousness about film and television career. And I said, "Oh no, I'm a singer, you know." I don't know how to do television and movies. But a year later, I was broke, and I was going to get a job at UCLA in the administration office signing up new students or something like that. And I got a phone call from this agent, said, "Have you changed your mind yet? There's a film that we think you'd be really right for. And you make an amazing amount of money in a short amount of time when you do films." And so I said, "Sure." And so that's how I got into doing film and television work. The film, that particular film was called Angel, Angel, Down We Go. And well, I did quite a few television shows and some films. The only film that was really, I don't know, Minnie and Moskowitz and Slaughterhouse Five were fairly reputable films that I was part of. And the television shows were the quality that you see, you know. I love to do film and television, but I don't like the scripts. Mm-hmm. And I don't like working with all male crews, and I don't like having women's lives constantly directed and defined by male writers and male directors. But once those things start to change, I don't think that I'll be an active participant in changing film and television, because I'm more interested in working with music. But there are other women who are really struggling with that, and are the work that I would do, say, in women's culture through music, and the work they do through around women's culture through film will eventually have effect on each other. And then when that happens, I'd like to do more film and television. I guess also I would do a film or a television show if it was, if the compromises were less than the gains. I mean, to do something that reaches every home in America is something someone really has to think about, whether they can do some good work in the context of that, even amidst compromises. And I just, you know, I don't make any rules for myself. Everything that comes up, I deal with as an individual thing. So if something, you know, comes up like that. I did a Partridge Family once, and I really thought that I could make some changes in the script and work on it. And in the end, I don't think that I did. It succeeded as much as I'd hoped to. But it was good for me to try. I think we get lazy, you know. We want to go to places where we're safe. We want to go to places where people already agree with us. And I think it's healthy for people to stick their neck out in those other places sometime and really struggle with reality. Yeah. It's that, of course, is the risk, is whether you start to enjoy your compromises. Build that swimming pool. Yeah. But I don't think that that's real likely at this particular time. And a couple years ago, I was real afraid of being pulled into all of that, into fame and fortune. But I feel pretty solid now with the communities that I work with and the people I work with, that they won't let that happen. You know, I think it has a lot to do with who you hang out with. And the people I spend time with now are becoming more and more critical of my work and more demanding. And so two things will happen. Either I'll burn out from their criticisms and react in some extreme way and join a Jesus movement or join whatever, or it will be a really wonderful alliance, and we'll be able to work in real responsible ways for a long time. You know, that's the risk we all take, though. I started singing. The first time I sang was when I was 7, and it was for a Veterans of Foreign Wars talent show. I feel like I've made full cycle, right? but I should give them credit due, I suppose. My sister, older sister, was a dancer, and she was 12. She was studied modern dance by herself. She didn't take classes, but she spent a lot of time choreographing and dancing. And she was going to be in the talent show, and I wanted to dance too. I wanted to copy her. And my mother, knowing that adults are real and sensitive to children, and that an adult audience would laugh at me if I got up and danced, because I wasn't going to, able to choreograph it, I would just put a record on and dance to my heart content, you know. And she was real aware that people would laugh and make fun, and that it would hurt my feelings. So she thought she would talk me into singing a song, because children, you know, I might be able to pull that one off better or something. And so I agreed, and I sang "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" from Oklahoma, and that was the beginning of my singing career. And so I suppose I had sung long before that, but it was the first time that I had thought of in terms of a performance. And from that time on, I sang at every tea and wedding and school function and whatever came along, convention.
Was that first one was the one where they were giving reviews to the Jell-O and everything else and didn't mention
it? Right. The very low consciousness of the support or the need for a culture, you know, the need that for music and art in our lives. People didn't respect it very much, and I never got paid. But amidst all of that sort of lack of acknowledgement was the fact that they did constantly invite me. I mean, they may not have appreciated it the way I wanted them to appreciate it, but that practice opportunity was there all the time, which is another benefit from coming from a small town. I don't know whether city children could have that same kind of support as being in a small town where there was just, you'd traditionally have some local person come and sing a couple songs. And I got used to having to do stuff on the spot, too. Some Sir Optimus Club or something, their theme would be south of the border or whatever, and they'd want me to sing a Spanish song, so I'd learn a Spanish song. And all kinds of strange ways that one learns their lessons that later they may use them in a different way. I mean, now if I have to write a song on the spot, it certainly won't be for a south of the border tea with a lot of white women attending, but that same kind of demand for high-pressure music writing, I got some practice from that. Or someone like Meg Christian, who spent a lot of times playing in clubs, you know, at happy hours or bars or dinner houses or any of those things where you had to know all the standards that ever came up, you know, had to be able to play everything anybody wanted to hear, is an excruciating way to have to deal with your music. Mm-hmm. But you can see it in her work. I mean, she's incredibly quick to learn and has a facility of retaining a lot of musical information, you know. And so we all learn these. I was a vice president in my school and head of a pep club and all that kind of stuff, and it was real tacky what we were organizing around, but I learned to organize. And it made, you know, you look back on it and say, what were we all worrying about? You know, how much money the cheerleaders could pay for their costumes or whatever. But the fact is, we learned those skills, which now we either put to good use or not. I mean, some people now are organized banks, and other people organize revolutions. But we all learned the skills from the same place. So.
At least you know how they learn. Do you want to just have that lead right into the other politics?
Let's see, politics. Well, since my parents came from some political roots, or at least developed their own political roots while they were growing up, there were a lot of books around, a lot of words, a lot of ideas talked over the morning coffee. And it was just a process of finding my own political focus. I bird-dogged for the Democratic Party when I was in high school, and I worked in student government, and I worked with another Mother for Peace in my first year of college, and you know, I sort of toyed with different kinds of political work. And then I started attending meetings of a group called the Entertainment Industry for Peace and Justice, which was down here in Hollywood, a lot of different people in the industry wanting to get together and acknowledge the fact that the people who run the industry, either as whether they're technicians or performers or promoters, do have control over the media if they all stopped working. So they were talking about developing some kind of a powerful unit that could have a political effect on the media. And it was a good idea, but it was before its time, and there wasn't, people's egos were too involved, people's economic survival was too involved, so that good political decisions were not being made in a principled way. But out of that was where I heard Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland speak for the first time about the FTA tour, the Free the Army show, which they had been part of for some time before that. And they were talking about it as an example of the way people can do political culture and put it to use in a political way. So a while later, an opening came in that show, and I auditioned for it and became part of the company, and we went to the Pacific, to the Philippines and Okinawa and Japan and Hawaii. And I saw imperialism for the first time in a real clear way. I mean, I'm sure that I'd seen it before, but I didn't recognize it or call it anything. And it changed my life, talking to GIs and service women who were really living out the horrors of the war, which we were all demonstrating against back home, and meeting Filipino revolutionaries and Okinawan strikers who were striking against the military because their wages were so low, or any of these different numbers of experiences, talking to Hawaiian women who had a high rape experience in Hawaii because GIs were sent there for rest and recuperation, and part of their training was that, you know, there's a Hawaiian girl there for you waiting, and that's not what she had in mind at all. So there was the GIs with their being misinformed by the military would attack these women, and then the male Hawaiians would beat up the GIs, and I mean, it was like a whole consciousness-raising thing for me around sexual politics and how it relates to the military, how it relates to imperialism, and what those connections were. So that just kept snowballing, you know. I came back and worked on the Pentagon Papers trial with the Ellsberg and Russo defense, and then put together a group along with several other people called the Indochina Peace Campaign. And we went out and traveled around the country talking about the war, trying to do a lot of outreach, playing state fairs, churches, places like that, to explain to people why the war was wrong. And this went on for 2 years. It was the most intense tour work I think I'd ever done to date up to that time. We were out 9 weeks without a day off, doing 5 and 6 events a day, and I'd never been put to work like that before. Well, it's a good training thing, you know. It was a really highly disciplined group, but I don't ever want to do anything quite that hard again, because when I got back, I just was exhausted and couldn't move, and they bombed Hanoi, and I didn't have any reserve left to react to a new crisis. And I learned a lesson about that one should never work as if they can rest after it's over, because there will never be any rest. You've got to find your own work pace and be able to do it for the rest of your life. You know, and that's
that burnout syndrome is really dangerous.
Yeah, the very high burnout record, I think. So that sort of leads up to having become known around political communities across the country as a political singer, which of course eventually put me in touch with women who were working in women's culture and were becoming well-known in women's communities for being the political spokespeople of the women's movement. And my consciousness about women grew a lot while working with anti-imperialism, because sexism is a huge byproduct of imperialism. But I hadn't really started working with women's community in this country, and certainly had very low consciousness about lesbian politics. And after the first all-women event I worked on was the Building Women concert in Los Angeles, where I met Alice Stone. It was what?
When was that?
That was a year ago. June was the performance. So in May of 75, I met the women from Alice Stone. I had met Chris Williamson and Margie Adam before that, and done some music with Chris. And then Meg Christian, I met her for the first time then. And we had heard about each other. I remember talking from the stage several times about there's this record company that's owned by all women called Olivia. And, you know, if you're interested, find out about them. But I didn't know much about them. I just knew that they existed. And they had heard things from one point in time or another about this woman singing in the anti-war movement. But the saddest part to me is that we didn't find reason to find each other sooner. And it's a lesson to learn from now on when I hear of artists who are doing things in a field that I might not be interested in, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to touch base to see whether after certain political struggles we might be able to come together around issues. So that's how I started getting in touch with the women's community, was through music. I mean, that's how music has gotten me in touch with everything I've ever done. It's been my ticket to experience. And it's been a real good way to find out about the world, you know, is to sort of ride in on the music and then have the politics totally overwhelm my life and change it, you know, what's happening. But, it, you know, it's a good combination of things to work with. And people just have to find out what their own interest is. It doesn't have to be music. It doesn't have to be performing. And use it as a tool to get into political work, because everybody's skills are needed in one way or the other, and if they're not, then they should find a way for those skills to be needed. I mean, if a movement doesn't need your skills, then the movement's in error, not you, and you have to become part of that movement, which creates a working space for everybody. And the movement the movement doesn't exist without people making it what they want it to be. I mean, a lot of people say, gee, I went to the women's movement and it didn't say, come right in, here's a job at 4:50 an hour, da-da-da-da-da, you know? I mean, you have to make it your own. And at this point in time, since there's no political parties that are unifying in this country, you know?
So that the women's building concert, whatever that was, right after that you started Women on Rails?
Sort of the time schedule on that was, June was the Building Women concert, which was a pretty broad-based outreach thing. Lily Tomlin worked on it. And then, let's see, in November, or sometime in the fall, Marianne Schneller came over to my house, and we were talking about, she was talking about how sad she was that so many times she would see women doing their beautiful music and having to do it in, under bad conditions, and also the fact that there was very little political organizing done around these concerts, which brought all these women together. And so out of that came the idea of doing a concert tour. And she presented the idea to Meg, Chris, Margie, and I. And we all said, well, we don't have any time in our lives right now. We are all crazy with work, but we want to do this real bad. So everybody moved their schedules around to be able to take have 2 weeks of practice and 2 weeks of performing. And we all went out on the road after that. And Marianne said, I'll mobilize the tour. When you come back, you can go right into practice and we'll have it together. Well, all of us operated on a real element of naivete, you know. We were just all wanting to do the music and forgot that there were going to be political differences and disagreements and huge struggles and all those kind of things. And we got back and there was a need for these 12-hour meetings, you know, with women from all over California who were committing their time and energy to this, and they wanted some answers from us, and we realized we wanted a lot of answers from them too. And the main problem with the Women on Wheels tour was that we hadn't in advance realized that there was a need to schedule in time for political struggle and political process before getting to the event. But even with that error, which was a huge error, the effect of Women on Wheels tour was monumental, and a lot of consciousness raising was done around CIW, the women's prison, and which later, when there was a demonstration held in Sacramento, 1,000 women showed up. So the effect of that that cultural event in political terms was huge, and I have a lot of positive feelings about learning from our mistakes and doing it again, not necessarily with the same performers, other women who might want to be the performers, but a political and cultural coming together to aid and abet each other, you know, because the impact of the concert was much greater because it had political focus, and the impact of the politics was much greater because there was cultural support behind it. So,
incredible.
It was a good event, and I think we learned a lot. We have a great deal more to learn about the politics of music and how it should be used. And a lot of questions came up. A lot of the same questions you are raising here. You know, of what is women's music? And hours and hours of conversations around that, you know? I mean, to me, women's music is not something that I am ready to put a definition on, because it's, you know, I want to wait and see. I do know that women have been making music since the beginning of time, and I do know that women from all cultures have been making music. They may have had to do it in underground in certain cultures, because they would have been burned at the stake Or they may have had to do it with anonymous names or men's names or in disguise. But they have been making music since the beginning of time. So it's trying to join forces with historians and along with musicians and along with the research capabilities of women and whatever to find out what women's music really is. Regardless of how one defines it, you know, in terms of chords and rhythms or lyrics or its presentation, all of which to me are real important to look at. Like, I think that there's the way women's music is presented and for whom and the way it's played and the way it sounds and all of those things need to be taken into consideration when talking about women's music. But the most important thing to me is that people now are starting to understand that women's culture is an essential thing to be developed and that it has been robbed of women, and that why is it okay for there to be, and of course blacks had to struggle for this, they had to fight for their right to have their own culture, but it is now acknowledged that there are different cultures in different kinds of societies from different nations around the world. Your most liberal of groups will, or even your most reactionary groups will acknowledge that there are these different cultures taking place. And I had this vision of a man with a black shoes and white socks and a Hawaiian shirt on for a minute. I don't know why that came into my mind. But I mean, there are these cultures and there are those people who rip it off. But women's culture has been totally denied, as if it were, what do you mean women's culture? You know, you don't have a culture. You are not a group unto yourselves. You are an appendage of the man and the race that he carries, you know. And so women are starting to say, no, we do have one, and we need a lot of space and time by ourselves to develop it. And even after we develop it, we may not be willing to share it with you because we've seen how you've ripped off other cultures, you know. There's going to be a lot of time needed to develop the answers to that question. But I think it's really important for cultural workers to be clear. Like, for instance, I work sometimes with a man, and I write music with a man sometimes, and people have been calling that, and I may have done it too before I learned better, have been calling that women's music because I write about women. But if I write with a man and he writes the music, or we write the music and words together, or whatever, that is people's culture. That is coming from a man-woman space, and a word for that is people. And that's okay. It's all right to develop people's culture. In fact, it's essential that we have a people's culture and a people's politic and people's events and times when people who have committed themselves to working together come together to do that, you know, around coalition issues. But it shouldn't be called women's music. And women's music is written by women, and it's for women, and it's about women. And when I do a concert now that is called An Evening of Women's Music, I have to struggle with the fact that, yes, it generally is, but I might do Nicolaya, which Jeff and I wrote together, and is that misleading to people, you know? So it gets down to real hair splitting, and eventually, to me, pure women's music will be by women, for women, and about women, and in an environmental space which women create for themselves. But at this point, that kind of purity is hard to put, you know.
Divide your music then, saying some of it's people music and some of it is women's music, depending on what part you played in it.
Right. For instance, if I did a song that I've written myself, which was written for women. I have a song called Imagine My Surprise, which I wrote about women in the past who were lesbians. We were never told about them. We were taught about other women, but if we were taught about them, they just somehow kept that part of their life quiet or whatever. So it's a song about that. And to me, that's very much women's music. It came from a woman-identified experience, a woman-identified realization, a lesson I'd learned from women. It was written by a woman. It was by a woman. It was written for a woman. But if I sang it at a mixed concert, the environment in which I'm singing it is not a women's environment. So I still don't, you know, I would still include that in my people's music concert. I mean, because it's being done for people. You know, and I really don't spend too much time nitpicking on those kind of definitions. But if someone wants to confront me on them, that's how I, what I believe about it. I would like to live in a place where people weren't so insecure about their sexuality that they feel uncomfortable at a women-only concert. I mean, if people were real willing for there to be women's culture and real willing for them to be women-only events and real willing for them to be women's nations, we wouldn't have to worry about all this. We just, there it would be. But that's not the case. So then you have to start getting into all these sort of verbal dialogues and explanations of what it is you're doing, which has become a real problem in terms of our promotion of events or my reputation as an artist or what people think or believe that I'm doing, because I have a commitment to both women's music, women's events, women-only situations, but at this point in time, I also still have a real high commitment to anti-imperialism, and most of the anti-imperialist organizations at this point in time are mixed, and even so far as most of them are male-identified. And so I'm not willing to give up anti-imperialist work, but I hope eventually to be able to be part of autonomous women's movement, which deals with class and race and imperialism and capitalism and all of those things, and also has a high woman identity to it. But that work is just being built real slowly right now. It hasn't, especially since many times women in revolutionary struggles in other nations and other places cannot afford to work with women only, because they're fighting for survival of their whole culture. And
did that cause conflicts at first? It looked like it did in Illinois. Where do you stand? Where is your place?
The conflicts that I feel around that are not so much inside myself. It's trying to explain it to other people who have more of a focus, a narrower focus on their work. For instance, in Champaign, Illinois, at the National Women's Music Festival, I was very, I clearly wanted my concert to be for women only. It's a women's music festival. Now, there's a thing called Title IX, which says they couldn't close it, but that's okay. I just wanted the acknowledgement of the fact that this should be, regardless of what the law is, this should be a women's music festival and for women. What happened in the midst of that kind of a statement of support for women's culture and women-only event was a whole slew of questions and concerns. Does that mean that you're no longer going to work with the farm workers, you're no longer going to work with Jeff, you're no longer going to talk to men, you hate men, well, what about all the men who need your music? And all of these different questions coming out, which, I mean, symbolic of the kind of thing that happened there is the moment a lesbian says something about lesbian music or lesbian culture or women-only event. The first question that usually comes out of the darkness out there is, but what about the men? And it's such a totally irrelevant question, because that's not what we're talking about. It's like I can't wait until the time when people understand that's not the issue. Mm-hmm. I was doing a rap about women in prison at one of my concerts. And it was a mixed concert, and I was working with Jeff. Clearly, my relationship with him makes a statement about my politics in terms of that concert. You know, we were not playing in isolation. We were out there working together and in a mixed event. And but I'm talking about women in prison, and a man calls out from the audience, "What about men in prison?" And I thought I would just, I mean, I could not believe someone would really ask that question, as if discussing women in prison meant, well, what we really want is women to get out of prison, but we don't care if men are there. We want to keep men in prison, right? And it was so totally self-oriented question that had nothing to do with the politics of what we were talking about. And incredibly defensive about being afraid of women who choose to work with women. And I've gotten letters from men who say, your concerts have become more and more about women and more anti-man, and if that's what the way you're going, I support your right to do what you want to do, but if you're going to leave me out all the time, I'm not going to enjoy your music. And Well, I don't have anything else to say about that, except that it's almost to the point where I find, you know, I'll send those letters to Jeff because I've gotten to the point where I don't want to deal with that kind of mentality anymore. And he has very good politics about that and understands that it's men's responsibility to take care of men's ignorance. And so he handles those things a lot of times. More men should get involved in that kind of work. Instead of sitting around wanting women to babysit and take care of their movement, they should get off. Really, do it themselves.
We didn't get any kind of definition, whether it be the things that women's music is not or the things that women's music could be broadly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's obvious in just the way you perform that you're different from, you know, what is normally presented to people as music, you know, if you want to get into that, or the lyrics that you write, which deals with both imperialistic concerns and women's concerns. I don't know.
Well, at this point, it's real hard to separate my music as to say, well, the reason I do something is because it's women's music, or the reason I do something is because it's political music, or what reason, you know, because my training came from a real hodgepodge of stuff. I listened to the Weavers. I listened to Paul Robeson. I listened to Judy Garland. I listened to Broadway shows. I listened to Leontine Price, who's an opera singer. I mean, those were my constantly bombarding me as I was growing up. And I feel now that my presentation is still a mixture of all those influences. And women's influence is now becoming clearly part of that performance. And I think sometimes culture should be talked in terms of its goals and how it's influenced and who it serves, rather than it necessarily a stylistic description that what I do it because I'm a woman or something. You know, I mean, I don't know how to seek that out.
I think the only way that could be answered is through musical form. Is there something different in the form too? You as a woman, what comes out of you?
I don't know. I don't know that. I'm not ready to assume that form. I'm sure that there are different forms to experiment with. I mean, I know, for instance, the Vietnamese have a musical form, they have a different scale.
Mm-hmm.
But they have lived as a Vietnamese nation, even though they've been attacked all their lives. They have maintained one of the high priorities in their lives, even underground when they were invaded by the Chinese and by the French and by the United States, has been to protect their national heritage, their original Vietnamese culture. Their stories. I mean, even if they were whispered, it's against the law to. I mean, the Vietnamese were told that they were ancestors of the Gauls. You know, that's how ripped off they were. And yet, underneath, there were still these little fairy tales going on that were illegal, that was in fact their history. So, we are all influenced by male culture. There's no way that we can completely eliminate ourselves of that right now, but we are trying to go back and find what part of that culture was the woman that was affecting the development of the society. And I think that some women are very interested in that discussion. I'm more interested in trying to find out what it is that women need and once we decide what we need, then finding the people who can serve those needs, you know. And I don't know what those needs are yet, but at different events you start to see what kind of things people respond to. Women have a need to sing, and you write a song that women can sing on, and they will, and it fulfills a need that they have. Women have a need to hear songs about women loving women. So when finally Meg Christian started singing songs that were their songs and not being afraid to say so from the stage, or any number of other women who have identified themselves as lesbian artists, they are fulfilling a need. And after we start fulfilling the different needs of women, maybe that's when we'll start to see what kind of a culture we've developed, rather than try to decide in advance, this is what it will be. We just try to serve each other, and then we will have developed our culture. I think that's how cultures happen, you know. People who live in the mountains develop a different kind of karate than people who live on the flatlands. It's not because they sit down and say, well, we will have this kind. They create things that serve them, you know, that are useful to them. And I took what I learned as I was growing up, whether it was Broadway or jazz or folk music, and took the elements of all of that that was useful to me so that I could present a kind of music, a political music, that was useful to those people who were supporting me, you know, which initially, for starters, was the anti-war movement. And that's how my art form got developed. That's probably what will happen with women's culture. You know, that's why an audience, or the listeners, or the promoters, or the women's lives experience are so essential to the developing of that culture. Some artist isn't going to come in and intellectually decide this is women's music. You know, it will come from the lives that all the women in the world are living. And hopefully, the women's movement will be wise enough to not let that cultural development be led and totally influenced by white middle-class women.
Which it is.
Right now, it's a very white middle class movement, and that needs to be struggled with real hard, because racism and class oppression are things that are used by patriarchies to keep people down, and women have got to let go of all those things which they've been taught. I mean, we were all taught it. It's no surprise that we're racist. It's the responsibility of women to develop feminism in practice. Not really.
Oh.
The difference when you're defining music and calling it something, black music, women's music, lesbian music, basically why we title those things is because it speaks to the needs of that particular group of people. So black music speaks to the needs of black people, or should. I know it's been co-opted by the industry a lot, just as reggae has. But the initial black roots of music spoke to the needs and was developed by black people. And women's music is doing the same thing. The difference perhaps between women's music and lesbian music is that lesbian music speaks more directly to the needs of lesbians. And those differences between a general woman's movement and a lesbian movement has to do with lesbians have chosen to relate to women and have chosen to give up the ultimate connection to male privilege and heterosexual privilege. And so there's basic political differences between within a general woman's music movement and a lesbian movement. But there's places of commonality in our womanhood that will cross different cultures, which will cross our color, class, race, and sexual political differences. And it's those points of unity that to me will be what women's music is. And there will be branches out of that which will more specifically serve women from different life experiences or race or class or whatever other livelihood they're part of.
I thought you were going to give me a yes or a no, and I just You want to get, well, you've been talking a lot about culture. Do you want to get into separatism and your part of the culture?
Oh, I guess a little bit. Separatism is a political ideology, as I understand it, that women under great, with great difficulty because of where the society they live in, are trying to put to practice. And separatism means a lot of different things. There are different kinds of separatists, different elements of separatism. And I don't feel afraid of separatism at all anymore. I used to be terrified by that thought. But I also don't know enough about it to explain it, or to define what one kind of separatism might be versus another. I only know that I think it's our responsibility as women to study separatism from a lot of different kinds of separatists and find out what their goals are, what their political process is, what their intentions are, and what kind of a society they're looking for in the end, and be open to the challenge of what that might mean in terms of developing women's politics. And I would like to see more women be willing to open themselves up to that discussion over a long period of time, not just one conversation, which may end in a heated argument, you know, which it seems to. But you're dealing with very, very tender places in all of us, you know, which is our lives as women. And it seems important to at least talk about those things. It also seems important when you go into a political discussion to realize who is the more privileged of the two groups discussing. When men and women sit down to talk, men have got to realize that they have one up on women in terms of their birth-given privilege in a male society, and they have got to do the listening. And in a situation where straight women are talking to lesbian women, then it's real important that straight women do the listening, because their heterosexual association puts them in a place of privilege, and it's going to be much easier for them to make judgments. And when lesbians who work in a general women's movement talk to lesbians who are separatists, then they should do the listening to the separatists. I mean, there, it seems to me that is the only way to have these initial political dialogues, and then after that kind of trust is built, then you can start talking back a little bit. But right, so. But it's a real curious thing to me, and I'm real interested in it. But at this point, I don't practice it. I support it. Like I would do events that separatist groups put on, or would seek that out to support their work. Because if they don't get support, how will they ever find out whether the work that they're trying to do is really useful to any of us? But at this point in time, I still do mixed events, and still that. There's something misleading about that. Some separatists do mixed events, so that's, you know, their outreach politics would be to reach women who would be afraid to come to a close concert. So, again, there's all these different kinds of separatism.
But do you see it as a way of protecting the culture?
I feel like lesbians initiated women's music, and they have to be given control of it for it to be preserved. Mm-hmm. Just, and a lot of those women who were initially the most women identified to realize they needed a culture were separatists. And so if they are, if it is ripped out of their hands, you know, you made it up, but now go away, we don't want to have anything to do with you, that to me will be a really great sin. You know, I think a lot of respect and caring has to go out to those women who dared to separate themselves from that which oppresses us. You know? I think it's a real courageous act. public versus private, is that where we are?
Yeah, or without being a public figure, keeping your privacy.
And responsibility.
Responsibility.
I think certain responsibilities are taken on when you become a public person. As a public person, you have to be willing to be challenged by those people's attention who you're, you know, if you go to some place and ask people to come and listen to you, then you have to open yourself up to hear them in return, either by making your address accessible or having workshops where people can come and talk or whatever. I think that kind of accessibility is real important. Otherwise, there's a real imbalance of power. You have the speaker who has the microphone, and or the singer who has the microphone and the records or whatever, and that group of people who are supporting them has no way of voicing any of their discontents, and their contents might be greater than their discontents, and so they have to take what they can get, as it were. In this society, there's so few artists that are dealing with people's needs that we're all starved, you know. We'll take whatever little crumbs we can get, and public people shouldn't take advantage of that starvation.
What happens when the demands get so great on you, though, that you can't function?
Well, the responsibility to me of the audience, then, is to be aware that they are dealing with a human being, not a superhuman person, and to respect that public person's needs. Like, for instance, after a concert, it's very hard to get into a huge political discussion. I just burn up a whole lot of energy, and I'm bound to be defensive, you know, if someone comes up, and it would be much better if that person wrote me a letter, mm-hmm. so that in the calm of another time, I could really give due attention to what they had to say. You know, and setting up a dynamic where people who want to talk to you understand what is the best way to do that, and for me to know what their needs are, and for they to know what my needs are. And that's something that just has to be worked out over time.
Basically your responsibility to say what your needs are? You must have heard about the Sophie's concert with Lily Tomlin and Chris Williamson.
The which concert?
At Sophie's. Oh. Alto.
I heard they were doing it, but I didn't know what happened.
It was another Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. I mean, it's just... And I think one of the problems coming from all sides, but if Chris had just said, I'm very tired and cannot handle anything right now, and said that need, it would have been understood. But instead, she just got irate, and I think I can understand why.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't interact at all.
Well, part of the problem is that people who are public people carry power, and they carry privilege. We're back to those two words again. And if you have those things, you've got to be willing to take on more than someone who doesn't have those things. I mean, you've got, and I've been attacked for elitism when I say that. Well, so you think leaders are better people than non-leaders or something. And that's really not the issue. The point is more that if you are going to ask for support, then you've got to give that support back in return. And that... It may be that after an event you're real tired, but then you've got to be willing to set up some other space for that dynamic to take place. You know, being open to criticism. I don't think that people should demand of a public person that they always be on and always be able to deal with everything, you know? I mean, there's a lot of us who've got a whole lot of problems in our lives that we don't talk about on stage, but they're there, you know? And it may be a woman has got a child that she's got to go home and take care of after she's through doing her show, or it may be that that she has a family that she's responsible to, or she may have an airplane to get to the next gig, or she may have any of those different things taking place. But somehow there's got to be some alternative dialogue set up, you know, like, I want to hear from you, here's my address. And the person who's asking for that dialogue, I feel it's their responsibility to be understanding that that is the only way that dialogue can take place. One of the things that happens in a concert of really good music is that the audience gets to know a great deal about the artist. They get this personal feeling, and they come up to the artist feeling as if they've known them all their life because they've shared so much of themselves. And that is in some way a misconception, because we're still strangers in some ways. We share, I share with my audience political unity, common ideology, common need for change, you know, all those kind of things. But I don't share a personal relationship with all of them.
They could have read about your background, where you're from. They know a lot about you.
Yeah, but they can't start to interpret that as being us being best friends, right? Or they're setting themselves up for disappointment, and eventually for really coming down hard on me if when they come up and say, hi, I'm Susan, if I don't go, oh, it's great to see you, you know, I haven't seen you in years. And it's just trying to figure out what that power dynamic is going to be. Artists have got to work at keeping themselves off pedestals, and people have got to work at fighting that which they are told all the time. I mean, billboards still exist. It's not like we are now living in a pure, perfect socialist society. Every day you're taught to have idols. And when you come to a concert where the artist doesn't want to be an idol, it's hard to shift gears and say, oh, that's not what we're doing. This is not the time to ask for an autograph. This is the time to ask, where is an organization I can join to put my energies to work because I have common feelings with you? I mean, that to me is, don't ask for my autograph. Ask for a place to plug in. Because really that's what people, like when I get... I call them support letters, but they were used to be called fan letters. Basically, what you hear in those letters is, I don't even know what questions to ask you. I don't even know what it is I'm feeling. I'm feeling something, and consequently, I'm going to put those feelings down on paper by saying, I love you, send me an autographed picture. But that's not really what they're saying. What they're really saying is, I was real moved, and you're the person who moved me, and I know that you're not what it is I'm looking for, so help me find what it is I'm looking for. And what they're looking for is something in their own community. And eventually, the way to bring politics and culture together will be for these cultural events to happen and political organizations to be right there to say, you are energized because you agree with the need for change, and here are the places you can plug in to be part of that change, you know. And a performer will then only be the mouthpiece, the vocal piece for inspiring that change or passing on information or whatever, as well as entertaining. You know, I don't want to deny the fact that there's entertainment involved here, you know, but but all of that, you can't just get rid of star tripping. You have to get rid of the society that promoted it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like chicken and an egg, and you can. Sometimes I feel like I'm chasing myself around in a circle, you know, because I'm not sure where to get off. And but it's getting a lot better. I mean, people, the difference between the way people respond. I mean, like if I do a club or something, someone might come up and. Or walk by and not even say hello because they're so sure there's this wall there between me and them, you know. But at a people's event or a women's event or an event where politics are really, people get excited around a particular focus, they may come up and say it was great or wave or something, but you see them going out with their arms around each other, you know, and rather than wishing they were going out with their arms around this idol that they came to see, which is how I used to feel when I went to concerts. I wished that I was riding home with them and sitting and having sherry after the after the show. You know, I wanted to be close to this person. It had moved me so much. Mm-hmm. And people are more finding that they really want to be close to the people that they work with, and that the music has just brought them all closer together. And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I mean, people are taking care of themselves, and it's great.
And also, like you were saying that you believe it's getting better. I see it getting better and getting worse. And I don't know why. Why? There's times when it goes right. When that happens, I mean, it's just, you know, it's fantastic. But then I guess I'm going to more and more concerts that have that bickering going on, or that demand put on you, or that expectation they come with. Illinois was one of them. Mm-hmm. Sophie's was another. I fell asleep in intermission at Sophie's. I mean, I started to get the same emotional reaction that I was getting from Illinois. And my reaction to that was to go to sleep.
To sleep, yeah.
You know, just to sleep alone. And I couldn't figure that out until I got outside of it again and figured out why I was tired, why I was such a drain again. And the difference between those two is I think Illinois had more politics behind it than Sophie's, but still the same thing happened. I don't know how to explain that.
Well, I was not offended by the demands put on me at Illinois.
I was offended by what happened to me at Illinois. I mean, my place there. I guess as a performer, were able to make your demands and be heard, or make it, say your needs and be heard. I, as a participant, was not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I started to feel ripped off towards the end.
Towards the collective or towards the performers?
Everybody. Including the participants, I mean, the rest of the audience. You know, it was just kind of like.
There was no place provided for people to really come together there. Those women we should not have left without all coming together to have some kind of.
There was a thing.
Somewhere. I mean, the criticism session? I wouldn't have gone to that for the world. You know? I felt so insulted by previous things that...
By the collective.
Yeah.
Not by the participants.
No, but I guess my feeling was that the collective was going to be the center of attention at that criticism session.
They weren't.
Mm.
Still didn't think anything happened there, but I mean, it started off with people being very annoyed that you weren't there.
Mm-hmm. I should have sent some kind of a letter explaining why we decided not to come. That was a bad thing on my part. But that's why I had that thing out in front of the hall, was that I didn't want to do anything with the collective at that point. I decided that we had put in a lot of hours into trying to work that out, and I was much more interested in talking to participants than I was to the collective.
Yeah.
And so that's why that event took place, where people would have, you know, the space to talk. But anyway,
yeah.
I would like that stuff not to be used in anything, you know.
Fine, yeah, I understand. I'm going to probably send you a transcript of the whole thing, and then
okay.
You just mark out what you don't want, but that I'll remember anyway.
Okay, good.
Which won't come until October.
Right.
Do you want to say anything more about responsibility? It's a real complicated issue.
Yeah, I think that there is some... some problems in women's concerts, where women are, because of the starvation that they're feeling, because they can't turn on the radio and hear women's music, because they can't go to a movie and see their lives portrayed in an honest way, or the television or whatever, they're once every 6 months, purge happens when some woman's concert takes place. And so they're all behaving in an unrealistic fashion. I mean, it's all locked up and everybody explodes. And hopefully when we all are getting more fulfillment more regularly, we won't be so willing to accept anything that comes along. Like, I feel women's audiences at this point are not very critical of the music, of the politics, of the event. Women are giving other women standing ovations time after time after time when those women don't deserve a stand. I mean, there are times when I don't do a performance that is worthy of that kind of praise, you know. And it is an insult to have that unconditional support all the time. It's, you find yourself wondering, did anybody listen? Or were they just having a good time being with each other? And, I mean, that's okay too, but what... The solution of that is for us to have more options. You know, there are communities where one woman's concert might come in a year, and maybe never, but they're not going to come to it and trash it, for sure. I mean, it's their breath and the light of day, you know, all that sort of... And we just need to develop a much more critical appreciation of our culture and demand a lot more of each other. You know? But that, again, is going to come with time, because... Yeah, the Bay Area is a real rare,
sure.
I mean, what other city has a gay sheriff or whatever it is, I don't know.
Sure, really. A bunch of other things.
Yeah. Really.
Yeah, and that gets even into the club, which I'll get into later. I don't want to bring that up again.
Okay.
Do I go into your changes now, or?
Sure, let's do art and politics first,
okay,
since we're
cool.
Sort of on that. Many times when I've done workshops with artists about art and politics, their great fear, and they immediately freak out about censorship in China, or I don't want to be told what to do and what not to do, or political art is always boring, or whatever. Those are the kinds of things that come up. And political people, when you do a workshop, are saying, the music we're listening to is boring, there's no politics to it, artists should not be allowed to do things which are detrimental to the people. So there's these two diametrically different criticisms of the same thing. And when you start to talk about art and politics, it seems very important to not assume that political art has to be unartistic, or that politics has to be art, that or that art can't retain its high quality and still be political. So the problem usually is that because great artists oftentimes do not have a political consciousness, and I'll go back to them, but political people who are doing political work and who need a culture have to split their energies and become the singers for their movement, become the cultural workers, do the graphics, do whatever, amidst doing all the leaflets, right, or amidst doing all the political work. And so because of their political commitments, they don't take 8 years out to learn to play the piano. They don't practice 4 or 5 hours a day. They don't do the things that it takes to become great artists.